Well, in the good days of ancient Greece, there was a philosopher by the name of Aristippus, and he decided to make a trip to another island and took a boat. He didn't know that the boat was run by pirates. And of course, in those days, when you traveled, you took your money with you. You didn't have any traveler's checks. You didn't have any negotiable securities or anything of that nature. So you took the cost of your trip right along in a little box among your baggage. While Aristippus was sitting quietly in his cabin, he heard some talking going on the deck outside, in which the captain of the pirate ship and his crew were preparing to dump him overboard and take the money. Well, it kind of perturbed him for a moment, but he realized there must be some solution. So the next morning when the sun came up, Aristippus was sitting out on the bowsprit of the boat with his feet dangling on each side, holding in his hands his cash box, and he was dropping the coins one by one into the ocean. And the pirate said, "What are you doing that for?" And Aristippus said very quietly, "'Tis better that the gold should perish for Aristippus than that Aristippus should perish for the gold." And as a result of this rather clever move, he was landed safely at his proper destination, but the trip was rather more expensive than he had expected. This morning we want to talk a little bit about the problem of money. In the first place, I don't think we should always condemn wealth as responsible for our financial difficulties. It is not wealth, it is man's relationship with it. It's what he does with it and how he gets it. The motives behind it and the motives that he starts into motion with it. The material itself is either paper, silver, gold, or copper. It has no moral problem of its own. It came from the earth and ultimately will return to it again. The whole problem is the matter of use and abuse. And it looks as though at the moment we are having what might be termed an economic dope problem. It looks as though money has suddenly become one of the most dangerous drugs with which the human being must contend. The situation is very close in its parallels. The individual takes the drug to feel high. The individual accumulates money to feel high, to feel superior, to fulfill ambition, and to gain some kind of economic advantage over other people. Now, these motives are not the highest nor the purest, and have resulted in thousands of years of tragedy. It was long known and still believed that you cannot trade any longer on a merchandise basis. You cannot swap a cow for two sheep or something of this nature. You cannot carry your collateral to the market with you. There has to be a medium of exchange. A medium of exchange is something by which there is a regulation of a transaction by means of which objects of physical and actual value are represented by an exchange medium, and the prices and the profits are judged by the possessors of the medium. Now, we know that in old times, wealth was very important, but not nearly so as now. Actually, nearly every ancient thinker realized that wealth was a substitute for internal maturity. The individual gained wealth to gain power, when he should have been trying to get whatever superiority he deserved through the advancement of his intellect, through the improvement of his character, and through the redemption of his various aptitudes and attitudes. Therefore, instead of growing, the individual seeks through power a possession. If he has enough of the medium, he is available to all types of opportunities. He has the privilege of enslaving others. He has the privilege of controlling the financial destinies of nations. But the whole thing is a great big financial tempest in a teapot. There is no rich person alive today, of any consequence certainly, who doesn't know that his days are numbered. He is perfectly aware of the fact that he cannot take any of this with him. He can also well often realize that in the accumulation of it, the only part of him that does survive physically, his reputation, is defiled. There is no one who really respects him. No one admires him. Men fear him and are often jealous of his possessions and attempt to rob him of them. Buddha was very clear on discussing this particular subject. He said the great poverty problem of poverty is that men sigh because they are not rich. The great problem of wealth is men sigh for fear their wealth will be taken from them. And most of these ends are actually experienced in daily existence. The problem, therefore, of the medium of exchange becomes very interesting and in many cases very complicated. We know that coinage was comparatively recent, 2,000 or 3,000 years, but the exchange problem went way back to the dawn of time. And most of our financial structure is based upon exchange processes. In other words, we're using money to accomplish that which we did without money at a previous time. The medium has now become all important in itself. And because of this, it has become a dismal failure upon the face of nature. The individual comes into this world with certain potentials. He is certainly more than merely a money grabber when he is born. He is not concerned in infancy with cash. He is rather concerned with the fulfillment of immediate needs and a constant need for love and attention. The individual, therefore, as he grows up in life, must accept and take on the economic situation of the world and generation in which he lives. But the person himself has potentials, and nature's intention is that man should live to grow, that he should become more, that he should understand better, that he should enrich life, and that he should cooperate with all other living things in the perpetuation of a just economy. This was a great problem. Some of the boys and girls of the last generation tried to solve it by various types of socialism. They also tried single tax. We went through a series of experiences with the mugwumps and many others. We went into pressures with Bellamy's Looking Backwards and all the utopians who have gone before. But out of all of this, nothing really satisfactory has emerged. Today, two great nations, China and the Soviet Union, are attempting to solve the economic problem by removing the incentive of wealth. Well, they've not been successful for the simple reason that without the incentive, nobody wanted to do anything. It became a matter of forcing the government or the nation to make a kind of slavery out of the population so that it would pay its own bills. This all came to a very sad showdown here in the great depressions through which we have passed in the present century. The actual answer, therefore, is to realize that the trouble lies not in the medium of exchange, nor in the theory of exchange. The problem lies in the abuse of the medium of exchange. And this abuse has increased constantly, until wealth has become the final incentive for the majority of human beings. Wealth may be in money, it might be in cattle, it may be in beads or wampum, but something that is generally valued has become the goal of our modern thinking and living. We do have idealists, we do have mystics, we do have philosophers, but for the most part, people are concerned primarily with the accumulation of material goods. And this accumulation necessitates an economic system which will provide them with the means to buy and sell. This economic system, of course, becomes more aggravated as time goes on. Little by little, it has resulted in what might be termed an age of increasing luxury. The idea now is success is luxury. Success is to reach that point in life where you do not need to work. Therefore, successful people have a very bad time afterwards, because not needing to do anything, they fail to develop any potential within themselves, except the privilege of spending, which soon becomes a burden upon the spirit. Now, the ancients had these schools of initiation. They had mysteries. They had systems of ritualism. And they had strange and wonderful pageantries to emphasize the workings of the divine will. All of these mysteries and pageantries consisted of various forms of temptation which had to be resisted. The individual had to be tempted to compromise his character in order to gain some insignificant or unreasonable reward. If he gave in to this temptation, he failed the test and was therefore no longer eligible for advancement on the level of human culture. So we have always some kind of initiation. In primitive times, these were physically painful. The individual often had to suffer from wounds and from various physical ailments brought on by the testing of character. Later, these wounds were no longer used, but various tests of attitudes became dominant. The individual seeking enlightenment had to prove that enlightenment came first. He had to prove the willingness to sacrifice most of the great advantages of wealth and luxury in order to improve his inner life. So today we have a great system of wealth which is not key to improvement. The individual and the community, the world in fact, in taking this test, the test of wealth, is failing the examination. Instead of having the courage to rise above the temptations of temporary gain, he takes the attitude, largely, that he wants what he wants as quickly as he can get it, because he does not know how long he will be here. Now, looking over the simple situation as it is, we wonder that people have ever been willing to take the attitudes that are now dominant. The individual, no matter how high his salary, no matter how many dividends he has, no matter how many homes and castles and chateaus he may purchase, is a fallible creature. He is a being that has a very temporal existence, subject to innumerable infirmities, and inevitably resulting in the final termination of material existence. Therefore, this entire process, which dominates the lives of probably 90% of human beings, is a process that is little better than a tempest in a teapot. The individual cannot take it with him, yet he is willing to commit crimes against humanity in order to get it. He is always fighting some way to protect it, but another criminal is waiting to take it from him. All of these processes are surrounded by one inevitable fact, that nature, the universe, the great plan of things, is simply indifferent to the whole subject. It is meaningless in terms of ultimates. It is meaningless in terms of anything and everything except a small life within this little atmosphere which we call mortality. Materialism is probably largely responsible for the spread of the wealth mania. Materialism, by denying the individual any spiritual overtones, denying him any hope of immortality, denying him any moral incentives for self-discipline or self-control, leads the average person into the problem of immediate satisfaction. He wants to have what he has while he can use it. But nearly all those who do this do not live to use it. They spend a little, lose a little, give a little, and have a lot taken from them. But the actual termination of the situation is not fortunate. And in being unfortunate, it grows, increases, and distributes itself throughout the world, resulting in war, crime, desolation, starvation, and massive infirmities, all of which, to one way or another, are related to the desire for personal gain, regardless of consequence. So we have here the whole world situation suspended from one essential point, and that essential point is superiority of the person himself. He wishes to be superior, and he feels that the only way to become superior is to gain wealth. All his education is toward wealth. All his attitudes in life are towards those public services which are well paid. Almost everything that he does is termed in the matters of his economic capacity. The more he has to spend, the more luxury and the more fulfillment of material desires. But these desires themselves are meaningless in the large pattern of things. The individual has all these advantages and still, when the time comes, passes on in a completely miserable state. I have had the privilege, or sorrow, in fact, of being present at the deathbeds of a number of wealthy people. At the last moment, there is this desperate search for consolation. And on his deathbed, the average millionaire would give it all for one more day of life. But he hadn't got it. And also, I've been with materialists who, at the last moment of life, in tears, begged me to assure them that there was something beyond death. There has to be something. And they had been educated out of the belief in the continuity of life. Why was this education thus stumped and prevented? Why was the individual allowed to grow up as a materialist? He was allowed to grow up as a materialist because he in that way helped to perpetuate the delusion of wealth. If he had ideals that were stronger than the possession of wealth, he would be considered an idealist. And as an idealist, completely impractical and destined and foreordained to poverty for the rest of his life. And yet, at the side by side in the graveyard, who can tell them apart? The idealist or the materialist? Both lie down together. And the only important thing is which one lies down with the best hope. Without this, the whole problem is a deadly failure. Now, nature has set this pattern the way it is for a very good reason. The individual has to prove the power within himself to control himself. He has to prove that the great evolutionary scheme to which he belongs, which is attempting to make something out of him, is succeeding. If the individual succeeds in living throughout his life with no improvement of character, no solution of temperamental delinquencies, no actual wisdom or thoughtfulness, very little kindness and not much real or sincere affection. In this condition, the individual does not grow, and he therefore passes out of this life very much the way he came in. He was a failure when he was born. He did not use anything that had been given to him to make life better or stronger. At the present moment in various parts of the world, materialistic social cultures are beginning to look at this matter a little differently. They are gradually realizing that materialism is a dead end. They do not have any more capacity to prove materialistic hypotheses than the idealistic ones. The dreamer has just as much evidence as the person suffering from the delusion of wealth. There is no way of proving that the material life of the individual can be made secure by any means other than the growth of character. He must become more in himself. To become more is to grow. To assemble or accumulate more is a very serious doubt as to whether he will grow or not. Now, if a person has wealth, either self-earned or by heredity, by the dispositions of circumstances or the Los Angeles lottery. If he has wealth, then the problem comes, what is he going to do with it? He lives in a world of people, most of whom are suffering. He is living today in a world under tyrannies that have brought tragedy to millions. He has now a power of wealth. What is he going to do with it? Is he simply going off somewhere and gamble it at Las Vegas? Is he going to buy another yacht? Is he going to do all these extravagant things and throw them in the faces of people who have nothing? This was the beginning of the French Revolution. This has been the cause of the overturning of systems. Nearly every major revolution of history was based upon an economic exploitation. The failure of that which has to help that which has not. This constitutes a problem for the distribution of wealth. As I mentioned before, Andrew Carnegie once said that it was right to live rich, but men should die poor. Before he comes to the end, all that he has should be made available to all who need. This problem of passing these vast fortunes on to persons who never earned them presents another problem. If the recipient, who has never earned it, wishes to become internally enlightened and dedicate his life to usefulness, he can take the accumulated wealth and use it for the benefit of all mankind. But if he has been given no incentives, if education has done nothing to enrich his character, if he continues to make his own appetite the final source of all demand, then the wealth problem goes on in cycles of misery until the whole system breaks down. So we look at for the moment on the fact of the matter. We have 70, 80, 90, maybe 100 years here. During this time, we are here for some kind of serious business. Now, serious business does not need to be a tragedy. Serious business does not mean that we must go from one misery to another. But it does mean that being here, we're in the presence of a great unfinished situation. We come into the world which is in itself in a midmost condition, somewhere between its own beginnings and its ultimates. We are here, therefore, as part of an ever-moving panorama of social change. We are here to become part of something that is trying to outgrow its own mistakes. We are not here long before we begin to realize what some of these mistakes are. We begin to realize that it is necessary either to overlook the suffering of others or else to make changes in our own disposition. The easy thing to do, of course, is to simply overlook the miseries of other people. But nature, again, is a little bit strict in this issue. If we do this long enough, we have social revolution. Because the underprivileged must have an opportunity. In China at the present time, the government is lifting restraint on private industry and private business. It's permitting people to earn something themselves. Now, this is probably a proper and natural thing. We should each of us earn what we have and what we need. We should not be a part of a socialized structure which bestows all necessities and leaves us no incentives to the development of higher resources. We cannot be made secure by being supported by the state. The support that we get is that which is given us to do something else with. Wherever life is supported, it is assumed that that life will reward this support by growth, by development, and by usefulness. If it does not accomplish these things, then we ultimately end in economic collapse. So we're now faced with the definite personal issue of saying, let us accept that for the moment we are going to be functioning under an economic system. That this economic system used can be of use to all of us. Abused can be the wreck of nations. Abuse is where selfishness takes over and dominates methodologies. The individual who is selfish is always in trouble. His selfishness never really brings him the consolation or the accumulation which he desires. If he gets that which he has not earned, it will slip through his fingers and disappear. We see that today in the vast aggravations in the financial level of life. With persons of comparatively slight abilities, by means of publicity and press agents, making millions of dollars a year. What are they doing with the millions? A few are known to be doing good things with some of it, at least. But for the most part, it slips away. And today, a large part of the wealth that is accumulated by lack of real integrity or understanding is being spent to buy narcotics. The vicious circle goes right on. And in this vicious circle, the two walls of birth and death still border the whole transaction, leaving us very little to be proud of as we go along. Now, we can't necessarily try to live other people's lives. We can't lead a parade to do a certain thing. Under some conditions, reforms are achieved, and then they are achieved, it is a wonderful thing. But a very large number of those most needing reforms reject them utterly. So we have another way in which we have to approach this thing. And that is, we have to begin all this reformation process by enlarging and deepening our own understanding. The only person whom we can lead successfully through this labyrinth is ourselves. We may be able to influence and inspire others, but the full test of material civilization rests with each person who lives in this world. Each individual on every level of life is confronted today with decisions, things he must decide in himself, attitudes that he must take, solutions that he must find, and if found, apply. As a result of that, no matter what position the individual may be in, whether he is in a dominated society in which he has really nothing to say, whether he is a free soul with everything to say, it is not important. The important thing is that each person must, in his own way, discover the reason for himself. He must discover the real meaning of wealth. He must know what money is intended for and how to use it properly. And he must realize that improper use becomes private and collective tragedy. He must take his various ambitions concerning his own economic future and subject these ambitions to the tests of integrity. If he wishes to be more than he is he willing to earn this improvement? If he wishes to become stronger in his determinations to keep the rules of life, he must strengthen his determination. In every way, the answer to the problem for the individual is not that he shall go off by himself and worry about the common good. The thing for him to do is to carefully note his own relationships with life and make sure that in this river that he is flowing down at the present time, he is learning what he is supposed to learn on the trip. We are here for a certain knowledge. We must, to fulfill natural law, leave this life at the end of a material incarnation better persons than we were when we came. If we were uncertain in childhood, we must be more certain in maturity, and most certain in elderly years. If we are idealists, we must believe ideals when we're young, we must apply them when we're old. Idealism is a way of life that is friendly, a way of life in which we live together in fraternity, a fraternity that is destroyed by ambition and very largely frustrated by wealth. So we must go about these matters in a new and more reasonable and intelligent manner. Everything that comes to us is an opportunity and a responsibility. Every person we know brings us something and asks something. This is inevitable. And very often we are glad to find the people who bring, but very reluctant to know the people who ask. Everything is not reciprocity. It is to get what we can and the other person do the best he can. All these attitudes are the destruction of a world order. Now, in times back in Egypt or China or India, the world order was rather sketchy. Very little of the world was known. Opportunities for wastefulness were comparatively limited. The various powerful political pressures towards materialism were not supported or sustained. While wealth did exist in antiquity, wealth was not regarded as a particular ornament because the wealth structure was overshadowed by the great mystery institutions. Every great civilization of the past has had a dominant religion which really did influence the followers, a religion to which every decent person gave allegiance, a religion in which the right of divinity to control humanity was unquestioned, and a system also in which all good was done in the name of eternal good. And the more good we did, the more immediate the environment improved. All these things were part of the Greek way of life, the Egyptian way, the Persian, the Hindu, the Buddhist. All these different nations had ethics, great systems of traditional integrities, which were supposed to dominate human conduct. Every religion in the world that has had troubles has had trouble as a result of departing from the original revelation. Wealth and power and ambition gradually took over and destroyed the supremacy of the spiritual revelation upon which a civilization had been based. Instead of therefore perpetuating the good, we used the good as a means of enslaving something, to dominate, to control, to take over, to press our own opinions upon others even though we couldn't live them ourselves. So nature, being what it is, has various discipline systems for creatures of differing degrees of evolution. There is one type of discipline for a rabbit and another type of discipline for a human being. And yet everything that lives is living in hazard and requires discipline to survive. There are laws for every creature, and any creature that breaks the laws is subject to self-destruction. Even the animal kingdoms have their internal integrations. They have a kind of mysterious intuition as to the needs of their own kind. And by observing each other, they gain the great education. In the animal kingdom, each type becomes learned by watching the works of that particular type in its daily existence. Whatever that type does that endangers it, the member must avoid. That which fulfills it, the member must cling to. All these things are part of natural law operating. And the moment an animal breaks natural law, it's lost. That is why my old friend Seton used to say so often, practically no animal ever dies of old age. It dies of the gradual failure of either its integrities or its vitalities. But never does it die a natural death. This is because of the way things are in life. Perhaps human beings do not die a natural death either. Perhaps much of the terror, pain, misery, suffering is due to the fact that we are not yet perfect, that we have not as yet developed the full measure of our humanity. Perhaps that very solution that will sometime result in the brotherhood of human beings will also result in a painless transition from one life to another. But we are here as we are, with our limitations, with our hopes, with our fears. And in these levels of insights, we have to solve the daily problem of existence. So we must try to prepare some kind of a code which we can live with injury to none and benefit to as many as possible. Whatever we have, we must use as wisely as we can. Wise use guarantees a new and greater supply. Whatever we have should never be wasted, thrown away, discarded, turned into something that is of no value to ourselves or anyone else. Take as good example of this, alcohol, narcotics, cigarettes, all these things which waste money, destroy health, and danger character in daily living. Out of these abuses arise a great deal of crime, and out of ambition for wealth, more crime, until the great crime organizations are very largely simply dishonest accumulators of profits. So all these things have to come back to us, and we have to start thinking about them, or the end is not going to be what we hope it is. So we must begin in our own way. The individual should, as much as he can, strive to maintain a contact with his own inner life. He must try to listen to the higher aspirations that naturally come to him. If he has a feeling, an aspiration, he mustn't immediately kill it off because it's impractical. He must not base everything upon the laws of a system that has failed. Rather, he must base his convictions as far as he can upon a system which has never failed. And failure is a symbol of inadequacy of some kind. Failure is inevitable because we do not know any better. But failure decreases as integrity increases. And we can sometime, in the fullness of time, outgrow our own failures. We are here to outgrow weakness, outgrow selfishness, outgrow over-ambition, and outgrow the complete dominance of our lives by physical considerations. If we were going to stay here for a long time, maybe 1,000 years or more, it might seem more reasonable to give a lot of attention to our physical existence. But with this short habit as we have, only a small part of time have we to live here. We must some way find out how we can use what we have to the advancement of a life that goes beyond our present embodiment. Now, a lot of people don't believe in immortality. And this term has been enhanced by a great deal of propaganda. The belief in immortality, if it is generally accepted and applied, would interfere considerably with the accumulation of unreasonable profits in many enterprises. If the individual has only now to do it, then he should do it all now. If he has only a few years to work before retirement, this becomes tremendously important. But somewhere behind all of this, as the wise have always realized, each of us has an eternal life, a life that goes on and on, far beyond the boundaries of any particular embodiment. Emerson was very strong and clear on these points, that there is an over-self that lives on, and that this over-self contains within it the records of all things done well, and also the resolution to correct the mistakes. Each person, therefore, can start in growing immediately if he wishes to look at his life, not necessarily simply philosophically, but in terms of plain old-fashioned common sense. If there is no future in something, why devote a life to it? If there is no justification for an attitude, why hold it tenaciously to the end of time? If the things we have we'll never be able to own, why make ownership such a tremendous factor? Why not admit that we are all here not to own, but to share, and that nothing that we have is more than a lease? We only have a lease on this physical body in which we live. And we certainly do not have total title to anything in our environment or any of our various achievements. The only thing that is eternal is locked within ourselves. That life that gives life to other things. These other things fade away, but that life continues, like the enduring rays of the sun. So we have to kind of think out how to get away from some of the miseries. Now, the moment you lower your ambitions to reasonable proportions, you get rid of a lot of worry. There's probably nothing at the present time that is doing more to create various forms of psychosis than our pressures. The individual struggling with things he cannot control becomes mentally and emotionally ill. Yet, ill as he is, he continues to fight desperately to keep on doing the things that made him ill. And his only outlet would be to stop doing it, and then his whole house of cards would fall apart. So whatever he does, or however he tries to get out of it, he is still in trouble. There is much, much more to be said about sanity than the mere fact of staying out of an institution. A psychological integration means that an individual has put his own mind in order. And while we turn now largely to science for keys of orientation, we must realize that these keys, all of them, originated in religion, and that the great healing power of life is integrity, and that this integrity means the doing of that which is most useful for all concerned. That which is good only for ourselves at the expense of others is a danger and a detriment. Therefore, if we really want to begin a better type of life, if we really want to get out of these psychoses that are now burdening us, we have to begin to do a lot of things that many of them hang on money. We have to find out, for example, how to handle the various problems of human association, parental association, husband and wife, parent and child, and self and the neighborhood. All these things have to be solved. And where any solution does not end in peace, there is no solution. The idea that we can solve a disinclination by avoiding it, if we can get away from people we don't like by never speaking to them again, all these are foolish non-answers to anything. Wherever there is an animosity, it must be corrected. And whether or not the other person corrects it, we must. We must reach a point where no animosities, no antagonisms, no criticisms or condemnations are permitted in our inner lives. For these are all causes of mental and emotional sickness. The person we hate may never know we hate them, but the hatred in us will eat us up. We cannot afford these things, especially when life becomes more complicated and critical. Whatever attitude we have when we go to bed at night must be at peace with life. We must never take to bed at night an antagonism or an animosity. If we do, it will be intensified by the sleep process, and if we repeat it long enough and often enough, it will sicken the mind and make us incapable of reasonable thinking. Wherever we start out, we are looking for peace. Now, peace at any price is not what we're looking for. But we are looking at the fact that peace must be earned, but that peace is an end, the only end to strife. That only the individual who within himself has found peace can survive the pressures of an unregenerate civilization. Only the person who can quietly estimate values, who is forever kind regardless of unkindness, is forever gentle in the face of cruelty, and is forever generous in the face of selfishness. Only this type of person is beginning to build those treasures where the thieves cannot come in and steal.